Robots Radio. Games. Lore. Stories. Community. Just press play.
Welcome, weary traveler. Need a short rest? Oh, I see. They said you'd be showing up about now. Come on, through the portal. Best not keep the Lore Mistress and Lore Master waiting. You know how they get.
Robots Radio presents the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. The best way for everyone from experienced dungeon masters to those curious about D&D to learn more about the worlds, creatures, and lore of Dungeons & Dragons.
Hello and welcome to the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. My name is Sergio.
My name is Sean.
And we are coming to you straight from the tower. I am curious. It seems that a lot of listeners tend to go back into the archives, go back into the older episodes and try to catch up, which I could understand that, you know, being the sort of OCD person that I am. But I also get hyper-focused and hyper-fixated on certain pieces of lore. So I could also see if I would, you know, jumping around and listening to lore that would, you know,
scratch
interest
that
me.
Itch.
Right.
Right.
And in fact, someone I think it was the Robots Radio Discord mentioned how they're loving all the recent Dragonlance stuff, which has been a lot of fun diving back into that. But one question that I'm wondering is, do relatively new listeners to the show, Do they know what the tower means? Like why we reference the tower? Why the actual play series is called Tales from the Tower? And I'm not sure that they do. So really quickly, some D&D Lorecast lore itself. When Tom, the founder of the Robots Radio Network Discord, Robots Radio Network, started the show with our good friend Stuart. The sort of the bit that they had was that they were ensconced. They were teleported to this magical tower where they had all these books of lore. And like that was sort of like the framework of the show, right? Like, hey, we're in the tower. We're going to talk. We found this book on gnomes. So now we're going to talk about gnomes. And so, you know, we kind of moved away from that framework, although we still reference the tower, obviously. But so for those of you who are, like I said, relatively new to the show, that is why we talk about the tower so much. That's some inside baseball, as it were. That's lore for the Lorecast.
Metal lore.
That is metal lore and meta lore. That's both of those things.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, we're talking about the Dragonlance sort of series that we've been working on. We've been talking a lot about Eberron as well, and Eberron's really cool. And we are going to talk the last war from the Eberron campaign setting. So the last war was a bitter struggle that forever changed the shape of Corvair. Corvair being the Faerun of the Forgotten Realms, the Ancillon of Kryn. It's the main continent where most of this action takes place. The last war spanned a century that was marked by shifting alliances, with years of stalemate interspersed with periods of intense battles. However, at its root, the last war was a war of succession. The dispute that marked the conflict was over which of King Jorat's five children would ascend to the throne of Galifar after his death. But first, let's figure out what led Eberron, or more specifically, the continent of Corvair, to this point. So for hundreds of years, the continent of Corvair was united under the kingdom of Galifar. King Geralt, the last king of the great kingdom of Galifar, inadvertently set the stage for the fall of the kingdom and the start of the last war. Which is ironic because for much of his reign, King Geralt was terrified of war. Dark dreams of a terrible future plagued him. Paranoia slowly filled his every thought as time went on. And so he devoted most of his considerable talents to enhancing his kingdom's defenses. He perceived no ends of threats. There were enemies everywhere. Conspiracies involving the dragon-marked houses, plots among the aristocracy of his own realm. He absolutely hated the realm of Arinol, which is the island continent to the southeast, totally convinced that the ancestor worshipping elves of that land coveted his beloved realm.
Not a great look.
It's like those dirty elves. I'm like, I understand you're from a different time, but that is not cool. To these concerns, he additionally added other threats that he believed were watching from even further distances, like the continent of Arganesen and the continent of Sarlona. The inspired of Rhaedra, who lived on the continent of Sarlona, he knew almost nothing about them, but he believed that they, and as well as the denizens of Arganesen, were waiting for the first sign of weakness before they could launch some devastating attack. And worst of all, in Jared's mind, were the unknown horrors that filled the mysterious continent of Zendrick. He had nightmares of this strange land that haunted him, and deep down he truly believed that the ruination of his realm would come from that direction. And so Jared's fears fed a military buildup, the likes of which Corvair had never seen before. Each single location, each city, each region was bristled with armaments. Additionally, and without revealing his overt fears, but with a desire to protect the kingdom and its people from the threats he believed were amassing all around him, King Geralt began a series of public works projects and secret experiments designed to reinforce the kingdom's infrastructure and borders while also increasing its capacity for war. I mean, it's during this same period that the lightning rail expanded throughout the kingdom. Geralt's beloved and trusted children, the governor princes of the Five Nations, increased their own standing armies and magical arsenals. So you have not just, you know, what's going on directly as a result of his paranoia, but also you have some benefits like the lightning rail expands. You have mass transit for all people. But then you have other consequences, like his kids start to form their own armies that are loyal to them, more or less.
Yeah, that seems like a fun thing to allow to happen.
Right, exactly. Have a bunch of your kids who could potentially rule everything, take over for you. Have them, field and amass an army that they...
That answers to them, yeah.
Right, exactly. Geralt instigated the research that would eventually lead to the modern Warforged, and himself lived to see the first Construct soldiers arrayed amid his armies. Also at his command, House Kenneth began work on the mobile fortresses that culminated in the deployment of Breeland's floating strongholds. And with the king's urging and approval, House Denith heavily recruited mercenaries from among the continent's more monstrous species. In hindsight, one could argue that Geralt's mental state appears to have been somewhat imbalanced. At the time, however, no one could challenge his viewpoints. I mean, no one had any interest in doing so. I mean, you have to be somewhat forward-thinking and a bit clairvoyant to see like all these little actions are going to end up culminating in something big, right?
Right.
you know, everything of itself doesn't seem like a huge deal. Like, okay, well,
right,
he's building up an army, like, not a, who, like, what, who cares, whatever. It gives,
who doesn't,
it gives those a sense of purpose that are in it. He's increasing the lightning rail. Well, that's a good thing. He's creating this living construct, new species. That's incredible. So, but you get all these things put together, and ouch time, to quote the great Gungans, it's going to be ouch time. And so the kingdom waited for the war. Geralt feared was approaching like a chill breeze on a hot, still night. However, that war that Geralt feared never erupted during his lifetime. However, thanks in no small part to the preparations he orchestrated, it eventually broke out after his death.
Classic Jarrett.
Like, that's pretty on brand for him. So what caused Geralt's nightmarish preoccupation with an invasion from beyond his kingdom? Some claim that some insidious alien entity caused his madness. They say that otherworldly or other planar beings infiltrated the king's dreams and planted the seeds of his paranoid imaginings. However, if that were the case, though, then why was there no outside force to intervene in the war once it began? You know, if this was the machinations of some other, not even worldly, but outside force, outside of Corvair, why didn't they show up to then reap the benefits once chaos had broke out?
Maybe it's just another step in a much bigger plan.
Maybe it's like the first episode of The Twilight Zone. They just want to see what would happen if they turned off the lights.
Some men just want to watch the world burn. Well, I was thinking in terms of, you know, I've been rereading the Dune books, the Frank Herbert books. And, you know, there's an organization in those books called the Bene Gesserit. And, you know, they make their plans across the course of hundreds and hundreds, sometimes
thousands,
eventually
of
thousands.
Years.
Yeah, eventually. Yeah, when you get deep enough into the series, you're looking at like thousands of years of planning. So maybe there's this outside force isn't done.
No, I mean, and we'll see. Like, you know, we had this United Kingdom of Galifar, and by the end of this episode, you'll see exactly how that kingdom is fractured, almost probably, you know, irrevocably. And that may be, like you said, the first step of a much larger plan. Others claim that the true threat to Galifar came from the demon wastes. They posit that a force of entropy and destruction that spreads from Ashtakala, which is the city of ghosts, along pathways as much spiritual as material, corrupting every empire and bringing it to eventual ruin. This profoundly ahistorical view treats the fall of Galifar as an event unaffected by any immediate circumstances except the constant influence of a long-dead city of demons. And then finally, a few claim that the Scion's complicity is far deeper than suspected. The five rulers all conspired at one time or another to spread doubts about the strength of the kingdom of their father. Their insecurity and selfishness fed Geralt's tendencies, exacerbating the tension and increasing the military power at their disposal. However, whatever theory you may subscribe to, whatever, you know, belief you have as to why Geralt essentially became mad with paranoia, all these theories have one characteristic in common. They are searching for a deeper explanation for something that seems inexplicable. Because in truth, the people of Corvair had spent nearly 50 years, a half century, expecting war to erupt on their shore at any moments. And so under the weight of that expectation, it would be surprising if war had not broken out, at least eventually, right?
What an exhausting way to live. Just under constant threat of, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but that's what they did. So, I mean, it's, you prepare for war, you obviously shouldn't be surprised when war finally knocks at your doorstep.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the origins of the last war in terms of not just the machinations of Geralt and his paranoia and everything that led up to it, but exactly how it started. So Geralt attains the throne of Galifar. When he does this, none of his children were yet of an age to take over the administration of the Five Nations. So regents and the existing governor princes, Geralt's younger brothers and sisters, continued to govern and serve as mentors and teachers for Geralt's children. So, hey bro, hey sis, mentor my kid and teach them the ways of ruling as you do.
I'm too busy preparing for war to raise them
I'm
myself.
too busy having these really crazy dreams.
Being influenced by a long dead city of demons. You know how it is.
You
I need a nanny.
So Michonne, the oldest of Geralt's children, was sent to Sire to learn at the knee of her uncle and prepare for her role as governor prince and eventually monarch of Galifar, being the eldest, right? According to almost 9 centuries of tradition, that honor would go to Michonne, the oldest and the ruler of Sire. And so when it came for King Geralt to shuffle loose this mortal coil, Michonne prepared for the journey to Thronehold to attend her father's funeral and take the crown that was her birthright as the eldest scion. At this point, traditionally, Michonne's brothers and sister would abdicate their rule of the other nations, and Michonne's children themselves would be installed as the governor princes of the Five Nations. I mean, that's how succession has been handled for the entire history of Galifar, just as it was since Galifar united the kingdom, just as it would be forever. However, Michonne and the rest of the kingdom would soon discover that nothing remains the same forever. Nothing gold can stay, as our good friend Newfound Glory once told us.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they invented that
I'm
thought.
pretty sure. I
Yeah.
mean, that's the first thought I
Nope,
heard of.
nobody'd had that thought before.
At Geralt's state funeral, shortly thereafter, Michonne approaches her siblings to discuss the details of her coronation as Queen of Galifar. However, Michonne's siblings each brought armed troops to the funeral, armed troops that were, as you said earlier, loyal to them. And before Michonne could be crowned, Thalyn, the second oldest overall and the eldest son, challenged the right of eldest succession. He was widely rumored to be considered for the title of regent since Michonne had been a bit wild in her youth, wild enough to frighten some of the more stodgy nobles of the realm. And with loyal knights of the Silver Flame at his side, Thalyn asserted that he was a better choice to be king of Galifar. Prince Caius and Princess Rohan also supported Thalyn, insofar as they wanted a different method of selection to be put into place. Not so much like, we want Thalyn to rule, but more so like, well, Thalyn has a point. Like, why should it just be the oldest? Rohan, in fact, said, why should the oldest and weakest automatically gain the crown? She, in particular, declared that it was time for increased liberty and democracy, and that compliance with the tradition was inappropriate.
She's making a lot of sense.
Prince Rogar, who was Rohan's twin brother, however, did support Michonne's claim. So it's 3 against 2. And this was mostly due to the fact that Rogar was the only one with their father at his deathbed. And Geralt basically said, I need you to support Michonne when she makes her claim to the throne. And Geralt himself named Michonne. Like, this is the tradition. Michonne will take over for me once I pass. And so Rogar backed Michonne's claim, but the two of them had insufficient forces, or at that time, desire to exert their will over on their siblings. I mean, and you could probably understand that. Like, it's like, well, we'll talk it out. It'll be fine. Things are, our dad just passed. No one's in their right mind. Let's just, we'll
Tensions
figure
are
this out.
high. Yeah.
And so despite their father's wishes, the other three rejected Mishan and vowed to pit their personal guards against any action crowning her as queen. So Rogar was at least able to stop the children, the scions, from spilling royal blood at Thronehold. But the five siblings and their followers departed the island without reaching any resolution to the question of succession. And before the year was out, this being 894, the first battles of the last war erupted, and each sibling eventually declared his or her ambition to take the crown. And so for more than a century, the five nations were at war. Other nations arose during the conflict, shattering Galifar's dream into more than a dozen fragments. In late 894, Mishan formally declared herself Queen of Sire and united Galifar from her capital. She also gave her blessing to Rogar's announcement that he would assume the title of King of Ondair. And she sought coronation over the whole realm when she reached the island, but in truth invited only the nobles from her and her brother's lands to attend, from Sire and from Ondair. Her siblings then issued separate declarations challenging Mishan's claim, and then they each decreed that they too would henceforth be known as kings and queens.
What a bunch of jerks.
It's when I love this because, I mean, I haven't seen it. It's been memed. It's a very good show from what I understand, but the show is Succession, right?
Mm-hmm.
About a bunch of jerk kids trying to take over their dad's company, right?
Right.
And I feel that you could have that type of show with the Eberron filter on it, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's,
I mean,
a show.
Yeah. Very much
so.
We come up with
a new great show every single week here at the D&D Lorecast.
But come at us, wizards.
Well, we are going to take a quick break for the middle of the show. And when we come back, we are going to give a very brief synopsis of the Hundred Years' War, the last war. And like I said, it took 100 years.
That's too long.
Lots of stuff going on. Perhaps we'll do a mini series where we'll go in depth on each and every...
on each year. On do 100 year. Episodes.
Do 100 episodes, yeah. So yeah, we'll come back, but we'll discuss briefly the majority of the 100 years, and then really hone in on the ending of the war. Hey, it's the middle of the show. It's time for some middle of the show type stuff, like thanking you, the listener. Hey, thank you so much for listening to the show. If you want to support the show in other ways, there are all the different social medias that we're on. You can follow us on. You can join our Discord. You can sign up for the Patreon over at patreon.com/dndlorecast. You can leave 5-star reviews, basically doing all the stuff that you would normally do to support a podcast. And each and every single thing, from just listening to the show on a weekly basis to, like I said, telling a friend, signing up for the Patreon, following us on social medias, each and every one of those would be very much appreciated. Thank you so much for all you do. In terms of D&D news, we've got a brand new comic book, Dungeons & Dragons, The Thief of Many Things, from IDW Comics. It's written by Ellen Boner, who wrote The Honor Among Thieves comic prequel as well. The Thief of Many Things comic is a tale that hinges on the deck of many things and all the shenanigans it can bring. So definitely check that out. We've got a link in the show notes to information about how to read it. And a couple other pieces of news just to show how popular D&D is becoming. Converse, the makers of the famous Chuck Taylor All-Star shoes. I wore dozens of pairs in my punk rock days as a teenager and young adult. They are collaborating with D&D. They announced the line just a couple of days ago. We'll have a link in the show notes to check that stuff out. D&D shoes, D&D Chuck Taylors, which is, I feel like everything that I would have wanted as a 17-year-old punk rock kid. And then another cool bit of news about how big D&D is getting. The folks over at Dimension 20 are having a live show, which isn't, you know, all that uncommon for big actual plays to host, live events. But this one is happening at Madison Square Garden, which is, the tagline is the world's most famous arena. And obviously that's MSG's own slogan, but it'd be hard pressed to argue that if it's not the world's most famous, it's arguably one of the probably top five. But yeah, Dimension 20 is hosting a D&D event, a D&D live show at Madison Square Garden, which is very freaking cool. And in terms of homebrew content, well, we're talking about Eberron, and there hasn't been a whole lot of adventures in terms of official adventures for Eberron in the fifth edition, which is something I've lamented about the past. It feels like for fifth edition, Wizards puts out a campaign setting like Eberron, like Ravenloft, like Dragonlance, and then doesn't really support it. They put this out and then it is up to the homebrew community to come up with adventures for folks that want to continue playing in that setting. So what we're going to do is we're going to highlight some fifth edition conversions. So when Eberron was released in the third edition days, they also released a series of adventures that you could play individually or you could link them together in a sort of mini campaign. There was a handful of adventures, and for this week's homebrew corner of the week, we're going to highlight somebody's conversions. They've converted the first four adventures. They've converted the Forgotten Forge. They've converted Shadows of the Last War, Whispers of the Vampire's Blade, as well as Grasp of the Emerald Claw. Now, all these classic 3.5 adventures are set in Eberron. They have been converted to 5th edition rules, and they look fantastic. 5-star ratings. You can buy the entire bundle for less than $15. $12.95 will get you all four adventures, which will take your players from level 1 all the way up to level 6. They're also sold individually if you just want to dabble, maybe check the water a little bit. You can buy each one for about $4 or $5. But yeah, we'll have a link in the show notes to that. Definitely check it out if you are interested in the Eberron campaign and maybe don't have the time to homebrew an adventure, which, again, I love homebrewing my own campaign adventures, my own campaign settings, but sometimes I don't have the time. Sometimes I just want to dive into something that's already been written and run it from there. So definitely check that out if you want to experience some more Eberron fun. That being said, let's jump back to the show. Welcome back to the D&D Lorecast. We are talking the Last War. And Sean, how long was this Last War?
It was about a hundo years.
About a hundo. And we are going to discuss each and every year right now. Buckle up. Hold on to your butts. Here we go. No, we're going to very, very broadly paint over most of those 100 years.
We're going to skip a stone across the surface.
And then really hone in on those like last 2 or 3 years. And like we said before the break, we might go back and dig into the rest of the war. But a lot of it is, there's a lot of like Cold War stuff going on. So who knows? Who knows? If the lore cast denizens, the denizens of the tower, will it?
Demand it.
It shall be done. So, the assassination or the death of King Jorat of Galifar in 894 YK, it plunges the continent of Corvair into chaos as the ruling nations Ondaer, Breelin, Sire, Karnath, and Thrain, they all vie for control of the fractured kingdom. All the rulers of those five nations essentially stake claim to the throne. Thalen's vision marks a dark turn in Thrain's history, leading to a theocratic shift that aligns with the more aggressive tactics of Karnath and the undead legion of Atur. Karnath also faces dire circumstances with starvation and plague threatening the nation. The creation of undead soldiers, while crucial for military defense, becomes a diplomatic disaster. And the Siege of Esten sees Thrain, Karnith, and Breelin laying siege to the city with House Knyth, rendering it pretty much impregnable. The siege ultimately fails due to internal conflicts among the attackers. Now, this is essentially the early years of the war, the first 4 years, immediately following Jorrad's death, and then into the 10th century. So right around 900 YK, the next 50 years can be summed up as stalemates and proxy battles. Karnath's military strength becomes largely defensive, leading to the abandonment of some pre-war holdings to consolidate forces. Ondair and Breelin sponsor proxy battles in the southern Eldian reaches, characterized by brutal tactics and alleged atrocities. Karnath's use of advanced undead troops halts Ondair's progress and prevents a siege of Korth, forcing Ondarian troops to retreat. And finally, Karnath launches small-scale sorties and raids across the continent, targeting various regions from Ondair to the Talenta Plains. And then the second half of the century is what some consider to be the long road to peace. We are now in the seventh inning stretch, so to speak. We are over the hump. We are on the downslope home. So between 951 and 993 YK, the last war in Eberron continues to shape the continent of Corvair, leading to significant events and developments. First and foremost, Karnath suffers a second plague outbreak, which further weakens its military. They tried to consolidate its forces, which means abandoning even more pre-war holdings to minimize supply lines. Sire, on the other hand, enjoys relative stability, focusing on rebuilding and fortifying its borders. Breelin experiences internal strife as the nation struggles to recover from the war's toll. Thrain sees a rise in religious fervor, with the Silver Flame becoming more influential. And if you are interested in the Church of the Silver Flame, we have a humdinger of an episode on them with our good friend, This Effin' GM. So if you are interested in Eberron, we have a few, like this is what the third or fourth episode on Eberron we've done. And if you're really interested in the Church of Silver Flame, definitely check out that episode. So tensions between the nations remain high, with sporadic border skirmishes and proxy battles continuing. Karnath, despite its weakened state, launches even more small-scale attacks, raids across the continent. The war's toll becomes more apparent as the continent struggles to recover from now decades of conflict. At this point, we're looking at 50, 60, 70, 80 years of war. At this point, the nations begin to explore diplomatic avenues, seeking to end the war through negotiations. However, despite these efforts, the mistrust and animosity that has built up over the almost century-long war, it prevents any significant progress towards peace. And so how does the last war end? If you had to guess, Sean, I know you've gone over the notes, so you know what to expect. But if I were to tell you there was the last war and it ended, but there was still, it's not a complete, like we didn't, nuke everything to death.
Right. It's not Fallout.
What would you expect the ending to be to the last war?
I mean, I just don't see how they come back from all this tension. It seems like the nations are fairly evenly matched. Like nobody seems to be able to get a leg up on anybody else. So either some of them would have to be able to start working together, or somebody gets a leg up somehow. Or that third party we talked about earlier in the episode, puts their finger in the pie and, stirs it around a little. But it does. I don't think that is what happened, because you admitted earlier, we don't know if this is another step in the Bene Gesserit plan or not.
Right. If anything, the war ends in a somewhat familiar manner. If you have read the masterpiece Watchmen comic book by Alan Moore, this I feel this takes a inspiration from that ending. So the end of the war centers around an event known as the Day of Mourning. However, even before this a very important day, signs of the disaster to come abounded. Unnatural foes appeared on long bloodied battlefields. Strange mists gathered in lowlands. Odd noises plagued soldiers in their sleep. Then, 2 weeks before the event, many diviners and oracles actually lost their voices or their sight. In fact, one of the prophets of the tower in Sharn was said to have gone mad. Still, no one understood what all these things meant until it was too late. Kind of like the war itself. Everything in and of itself isn't really cause for concern. And no one really connected the dots and saw what it could mean once you put them all together.
Right.
And so, in mid-994, Sire launched a deep strike invasion of Karnath aimed at the undead-producing crypts of Atur. A large Siren army conducted a furious assault that left the city in ruins, and then, unwilling to get bogged down once again in Karnath, the invaders quickly reversed their march and returned home. With a hastily gathered and vengeful army of Karns at their heels, the troops crossed over Sion Sound and pulled back toward Metrol. Significant Karnathi forces gathered in pursuit, and a sizable conflict began developing in Northern Sire. This left few regular soldiers to protect other areas. Meanwhile, a recent pact between Thrain and Relish remained strong, and skirmishes as a result along their mutual borders were nearly non-existent. And these two countries stepped up relations and plotted a joint invasion of Sire. Marching south of the usual battlefields in Western Sire, the vanguard of the Breelish Thrain army quickly overwhelmed Kenrun and surged across northern Dragoon. The invaders reached an area then known as Sarun Road and paused to await the bulk of their troops before shifting northeast to attack the city of Making. The next day, the main body of Thrain and Breelish forces climbed up through the gullies and gorges to higher ground and cut the Sarun Road some 200 miles southwest of Making. However, through some series of quick hit-and-run maneuvers, thanks in part to the tireless Warforged, the vastly outnumbered Siren defenders gave the impression of being a much larger force than they actually were. And this illusion and the command and control problems it caused between the invading allies slow the advance significantly. Given impossible orders to delay and yet also preserve as much of their forces as possible, the Sirens performed brilliantly. On the second day, Siren reinforcements from the east made the battle more even. Although outnumbered, they were fighting on a familiar terrain. They were on their homeland. Late in the afternoon, their battle lines were holding. The outcome of the struggle was in doubt. When suddenly, the sky caught fire and deep fogs gathered. Generalship, morale, strategy, tactics, all were useless at that point. The conflagration that enveloped the field was so bright that it blinded soldiers at Angwar Keep, which was over the horizon and half a continent away. Both sides, both the Sirens and the attacking forces, died equally on the Day of Mourning. The devastation was not limited to the battlefield on the Sarun Road, which is now known as the Field of Ruins. The rolling hills to the east of the battlefield became a plateau of jagged glass, and to the north, a chasm opened up in the earth, glowing with a cold purple light. A choking fog erupted in cities across central Sire, killing every living thing it touched as it expanded to define the current borders of what is now known as the Mornland. However, not all of Sire's holdings were swallowed in this dead gray mist. Parts of Velenar, Dargoon, the Talenta Plain, they're still under Siren rule at the time. But Sire as a nation that day ceased to exist. Scant thousands of Sirens lived on the edges of devastation and managed to flee to safety. There were those who were traveling or living abroad at the time. Of course, they were spared. Many of these survivors have flocked to Eastern Breeland in the years since the day of mourning, gathering under the banner of Prince Orgev, who is the son of the late Queen Danelle, the Queen of Sire. Orgev was serving as an ambassador to Breeland on the day of mourning and now plays the role of a king in exile. The response to the Siren's plight after the mourning is one of the greatest indictments of Corvair's quote-unquote humanity. Although some did extend a hand to those in need, 100 years of war had hardened the hearts of these citizens so much that many refugees were turned away.
Not a great look.
Not a great look at all. Far more perished the days after the mourning than should have. When the extent of the destruction became clear, King Boronel, racked with guilt about his possible role in the cataclysm, was the first to allow unarmed refugees to pass through his lines. However, no other nation was as charitable. Keeper Darren of the Church of the Silver Flame spoke movingly about the faithful accepting and providing for the dispossessed and the substantial aid provided by the Purified since the end of the war. It's gone in some way to help the church's reputation, but the hardliners of the church, they roused the populace with stories of Siren depredations and plundering, which caused many to keep the bulk of the refugees out. Others established small communities, but again, no significant action was taken. The elves of Velenar were considered ruthless due to the fact that they slaughtered all who approached their lands. The goblinoids were no more forgiving.
It's a dark time.
Yeah, a very dark time. This obviously unexpected and unknown cataclysmic event takes place and kind of startles everyone, for the most part, into if not a sense of diplomacy, then at least a sense of apathy when it comes to war.
Yeah. It's a little different from Watchmen, where at the end it seemed like everybody was kind of pulling together. It doesn't seem like people were like that much warmer to each other. It sounds like some people tried, but it definitely, like, the end of Watchmen makes it seem like the whole world's coming together to get ready to fight off the alien threat.
To hold hands and it's similar, and in that respect that it's something from the outside. Right. Seemingly, you know, from the perspective of Watchmen, you know, for the most part, no one knows. Everyone suspects an alien invasion, right? But it's different with Eberron because, like you said, not everyone is that ready to, you know, be friendly and fight together again. It's more so like, okay, well, we won't continue killing you. We just, you know, you can do whatever you need to do, but we're not going to help, nor are we going to continue fighting.
And you're not allowed to come into our country.
And you can't come in. But at the very least, a treaty comes of this, the Treaty of Thronehold. Armies of all nations halted offensive operations as word of the disaster in Sire spread. A growing wave of refugees threatened to overwhelm Sire's neighbors. And although the panic began to subside when the mists halted at the former Siren border, the proud, powerful, ancient nation of Sire was no more. These events lifted the diplomatic stalemate, and negotiations by all sides increased significantly. Still, given that there was more than 100 years of war, even the cataclysmic events in Sire might not have guaranteed an end to hostilities. As it turned out, a confluence of circumstances and leaders made peace possible despite the monumental barriers. King Bornell of Breeland, shocked by the devastation and distraught at his own daughter's death, greatly desired a pause in fighting. Speaker Darren of Thrain exerted as much influence as she could in favor of peace, and High Cardinal Crozen and his supporters did not resist, because in truth, Thrain was completely spent. It was more like, okay, yeah, we won't fight, but really they couldn't anymore. King Arala of Ondair had a long history of skillful diplomacy, and she was anxious to shift the conflict from the fields of battle to the tables of negotiation, where she felt she could at least, if not dominate, at least have the upper hand. And finally, and most surprisingly, the old nemesis of negotiation, Carnath, they turned out to be a strong proponent for peace. The newest royal, Caius III, advanced a comprehensive plan for the withdrawal of forces and establishment of new boundaries, including the recognition of several more independent nations. As a measure of his good faith, King Bornell offered the moving fortress Argonth as a means to ferry diplomats to summits, and pledged that all who accepted such transport would be safe.
I want to travel in a moving fortress. That sounds awesome.
Well, immediately thereafter, the initial group of passengers, a team of Thrain negotiators, were slaughtered in a particularly gruesome manner.
I take it back.
But as it turned out, this setback actually aided the peace process, because the heroic actions of a King's Citadel investigator and the renowned paladin of the Silver Flame, Sir Valen Kalain, revealed that the responsible parties were warmongering agitators from both the Brelish security force and the Thrain delegation. And so these horrific deeds severely undermined the warmongering forces in both nations. So in a way, it's, you know, what they did was so horrible that it turned sort of the public opinion against them. By 996, real negotiations began at Thronehold, the site where the war had begun. Working from Caius III's proposal, the participants soon agreed to recognize Ondair, Breeland, Thrain, Carnath, and the Talenta Plains, as well as several other lands, as sovereign nations. When the question of Sire arose, Queen Arala gave voice to a widespread sentiment: Sire no longer exists. The delegates further reaffirmed Halastanith's role as an international police force and granted it full authority to preserve Thronehold. King Bornell's tenacity and charisma did lead to one major provision, which was the emancipation of the Warforged, which you and I discussed in our Warforged episode.
Yes, yeah. Love those Warforged.
King Caius III's dedication to peace showed when he continued to exert his considerable force of personality at the peace table, despite a desperate famine that struck his country that year. He was later rewarded when both Breeland and the Eldine Reaches offered food to his beleaguered population. Over the major disputes involved Ondair and Thrain, Queen Arala demanded the return of the city of Theolist, but was unwilling to concede pre-war Thrain lands now that were now safely behind her towers in the east. Thrain, of course, held the opposite stance. We want those pre-war lands back. In the end, it was Bornell who brought the two sides together by first raising the issue of Old Breeland, and then allowing himself to be talked away from it, from its return, if Ondair and Thrain essentially agreed to the status quo. The concessions on all sides were ultimately acknowledgments on paper of what had been true for almost 70 years on the ground. However, despite all this, the peace was neither universal nor complete. Minor skirmishes and raids continued as the countries slowly demobilized. Thrain and Ondair exchanged harsh words again over that land in question in 997 and again in 998. Still, the other nations made it clear that they wouldn't support Ondair, and so Queen Aralla backed down both times. And by 998, peace was finally established, if not entirely secure. The Empire of Galifar was finally and truly gone, and what would replace it was up to the new nations birthed in the last war. The Blade of Galifar soundly shattered and will most likely never again be reforged. Each of the five nations lost much, and none could point to any truly meaningful gain from all those years of sacrifice and bloodshed. And still, despite 100 years of war and a relatively short time of peace since, each of the five nations appears to be laying the groundwork for the next great conflict. Whether such preparations precipitate a conflagration, as what happened in the late 800s, or allow for a lasting peace, depends on the lessons that were learned in the forge of war.
That's the thing. Like they say in Fallout, war never changes. And really, it's people that don't change, right? Like, right, unfortunately, yeah.
Just the technology changes, the way the way we kill each other changes.
Right. Yeah. That.
The reasons as to why we're killing each other don't, but
not so
how
much,
we do it.
Yeah. Yeah. We get more clever and productive in our killing methods, but yeah, the reasons behind it stay pretty much the same. It's a bummer.
It's a bummer of an episode. I mean, yeah, if you thought that talking about a war that lasted 100 years was going to be a lot of fun, then well, jokes on you. But no, yeah, we'll talk more about Sire and the Mornland in the Patreon Plus installment to this episode. Get a little bit more into the Day of Mourning, possible sources as to, you know, where it came from. Perhaps it was the oft-mentioned third party sticking their finger in the pie and swirling it around.
You know, just messing stuff up.
You know, just for kicks. But yeah, if you want to learn more, or if you want to know more about Eberron or any other D&D lore, let us know. Hit us up on the social media, shoot us an email, holler at us on our Discord. And let us know what you want to hear about. And I'll tell you what, you're not gonna threaten me with a good time researching D&D lore.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining, Sean. Do you have anything you want to plug really quick?
Yeah. On April 30th, my Conan the Barbarian story, Lethal Consignment, is coming out from Penguin Random House. It'll just be an ebook. It's $2. You can get it at your favorite e-tailer. Read it on your phone, your tablet, your e-reader, what have you. And I would really appreciate it if you guys picked it up, because I would really love to get more jobs like this and play in these awesome sandboxes established by these great creators over the years.
So yeah, we'll have a link to that in the show notes. So it's $2. $2 is a fantastic way to spend a Saturday afternoon curled up with your Kindle or your iPad or your Nook and reading about Conan on a boat, on a ship.
Yep. He's on a ship.
Heck yeah.
Conan's first time on a ship, canonically speaking.
Conan the pirate?
It's before his pirate days.
Ah, I see.
This is very early in Conan's career. It's before, the Queen of the Black Coast, I think it's called.
Very early in his career of Conaning. So yeah, definitely check it out. In the meantime, we'll be back next week with some more lore. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Sergio.
Mine is still Sean.
Fare thee well, dear listener. And until we meet again, may all your 20s be natural.
Thank you for listening to the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. If you've enjoyed the show, consider following us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at D&D Lorecast, or jumping into the Robots Radio Discord to chat more with us about Dungeons & Dragons. We'll see you soon.
You've been listening to a Robots Radio podcast. Smart shows for interesting people. Check out all the shows at robotsradio.net.